Today we have for our first interview, which relates to freedom and power of European Constitutional Scholarship Workshop, Professor Alexander Somek, one of the contributors to the workshop, but also one of the intellectuals who contributed to the field significantly, not only of European constitutional law, but also legal philosophy, legal theory, and other areas of law and philosophy. And today I would like to focus on topics which have to do with the idea of scholarship, or as in German they say, the Rechtswissenschaft, and what it means for him and also his career, that he traveled a lot. And that's perhaps the question with which I would like to begin, since currently you are based in Vienna as the professor of legal philosophy, but you spent a considerable amount of time in the United States as a professor at the University of Iowa. So can you tell us a little bit about these moves across the Atlantic?
Yeah, that's a good question, because it's of great significance to my life. Let me go back a little bit to the time that I was still a so-called assistant in the faculty working for a professor. It was at this time, it was in the mid-1980s, I think, that I met the acquaintance of Stanley Paulson, who was a very famous Kelsen scholar. He was doing research on Kelsen in Vienna, but I wasn't interested in Kelsen, really, but in what was going on in the United States. And he introduced me, he gave me the first introduction to American legal scholarship, American legal theory, in particular to something that was quite fancy at the time, critical legal theory, critical legal studies. And this was the point of contact for me with American legal culture. I was interested in critical legal studies, as a result of which I applied for a research grant, was given the grant, spent a year at Harvard Law School doing research. And this was a life-altering experience, to be honest. Yeah, I was coming from a very traditional Viennese, German-speaking law faculty, the Viennese law faculty, which is to this day still very traditional, steeped in old traditions. And there, all of a sudden, I encountered the critical perspective that is so important, I think, for all of American legal scholarship on traditional legal doctrine. This is something that originated with the American legal realist movement, of course, but it has a legacy in the scholarship in the United States, and I encountered this legacy everywhere, wherever I went. It was most pronounced, of course, in critical legal scholarship, but wherever I went, I found an attempt to move beyond this old-fashioned way of doing legal science that we are still practicing and are practicing to this day on the European continent. So the encounter with American legal scholarship was liberating for me, yeah, intellectually liberating. And I had to go back, I submitted my Habilitationsschrift in Austria, a quite voluminous book with too many pages to read, in which I, for the first time, tried to bridge this gap between continental European German style legal theory and American legal theory. It laid the foundation for what I've done ever since. And this was going back and forth between the two legal traditions, engaged them in a conversation. So this is what I did. But soon after my return, it turned out that I was interested in leaving again and moving back, at least for a little while, to the United States. So several research stints were coming as a result of this Fulbright grant and so forth, until relatively late in my life. I was already in my early 40s. I had just turned 40. I was offered a visiting professorship in Iowa, and then afterwards, this is a long story made very short now, a full professorship, yeah, immediately. So I switched from my tenured position in Austria to a tenured position in the United States. And it was the most important thing to do for me in my life, because in a sense, intellectually, I ended up for the first time in my life at the right place, in American law school. Why is this the right place for me? Because I am essentially what I would call a legal academic. Jan, you were asking me the question before the interview started, a few days before. How do I look at myself? Am I a legal philosopher, a constitutional theorist, a theorist of EU law? I think I can sum it up in the best possible way by saying I am a legal academic. I'm someone who thinks and writes about law, not with the idea in the back of his head that the product of his thinking and writing is something that he has to sell to clients or something that will assist judges in reaching better decisions. This is the traditional continental European perspective, perhaps. A legal academic is free from these practical pressures and can therefore do two very important things that are intellectually extremely rewarding. First, a legal academic can take the internal perspective on the law really seriously. And this means that the legal academic doesn't have to stop asking questions at a certain point simply because of the exigencies of legal practice. Yeah. That you have to come to an end. You have to adopt a position and to argue the position. No, you can go on and go on further and explore the basic concepts of the law. Yeah. Basic concepts such as public law, private law. What is a right? What do you mean by justice and so forth? All these concepts that are always presupposed in legal scholarship that we use, yeah? And we have implicit understandings of what they mean. But what a legal academic can do is to make these explicit understandings explicit and to explore them at greater depth and to elaborate them. That's one thing that a legal academic can do. And if you do it, in particular in a continental European context, people will sooner or later call you a legal philosopher or legal theorist. But the line that is drawn usually between legal scholarship proper or legal scholarship properly understood on the one hand and legal theory as something that goes beyond it is a line that is socially drawn within faculties, and there's no intellectual merit to it whatsoever. Because all good legal scholarship has to be legal theoretical and legal philosophical. And that's my contention. And I'm not the only one who was of this opinion. Ronald Dworkin was of this opinion throughout his life. But you can even go beyond that, beyond exploring the internal perspective at greater depth. You can adopt the external perspective. You can look at what you are doing from the perspective of an external observer. You can look at the legal system that you study from the perspective of an external observer. And if you adopt the perspective of an external observer, you will look at the field of law that you study from, say, a historical perspective, from the perspective of sociological theory, or from the perspective of empirical studies, or from the perspective of psychology. So as soon as you move beyond your internal perspective and look at yourself from an external perspective as well, your legal scholarship becomes invariably and automatically interdisciplinary, as it is called, which means that you have to draw on the style of thinking and the insights that are provided by other disciplines, in particular in the social sciences, in order to understand the subject matter with which you're working. And this is what you do, Jan, in your work as well. Yeah, this is what you do because you are an accomplished legal academic. So let me go back to the United States. This is the one thing that the United States does better than we. It has better academic legal scholarship because the basic expectation is in good American law schools that if you want to be someone in the field of legal scholarship, you have to work in one way or in another in an interdisciplinary manner. And interdisciplinarity is a euphemism for what you do, what these people then do, because what they usually do is they use one particular discipline and apply it to the law. Yeah. So this is what is usually done in interdisciplinary legal scholarship. But this is what a university, legal academia, offers to people who have a sincere interest in the world and want to understand the world that they live in. Yeah. And this is what's driving me. I'm a legal academic. I want to explore the internal perspective at greater depth and also take the route to the external perspective. And this is why I am a legal philosopher, a public law scholar, and a EU law scholar, all under one hand. But I think for me, all of this fits perfectly well together. And one final remark, and then I'll let you ask a question again, because it's also something that's important to me. Being in this sense relatively American in my orientation is at the same time very consistent with the traditional understanding of what the public law scholar ought to do in the German language tradition. If you look at term from the 19th to the 20th century, but then in particular to the Weimar period in Germany, where people like Hermann Heller, Hans Kelsen, Carl Schmitt, and others were writing, what is it that they were doing? Yeah? they were basically doing interdisciplinary legal scholarship because they applied political science to their subject matter. They explored philosophical ideas in their work. Hans Kelsen developed a quite elaborate theory of law from the internal perspective. He didn't take the external perspective, but the internal perspective. So it is something that comes quite naturally to someone who comes from the tradition of German public law scholarship. So it is not by accident that you see German public law scholars such as Matthias Kumm, yeah, Armin von Bogdandy, maybe also Christoph Möllers, that you see that it is relatively easy for them to make the transition to the Anglo-American world, in particular to American legal scholarship, because it's something that's built into the genes of German public law scholarship already.
Well, that was a long and elaborate answer to the question, but still I will try to remain in this topic. You made this distinction. There are people who are employed at the law faculties, but at the same time, they have lots of side jobs. And in fact, what they are interested in is to write commentaries which would be useful for practice. Many of them would have their own practice. And then there are people who are doing, like, let's say, proper academic work, which is something I very much agree with you, this categorization and distinction you make. Now, you also said that academics, these proper legal academics, take the internal perspective on law seriously.
Yeah.
But still, I suppose there is a distinction between these and what we would call, again, in Europe, legal doctrine, because one of the primary purposes of legal doctrine is doing precisely the work which is useful for courts, for public officials, for the practice of law. Right. Now, I know that what academics are doing is also useful in some sense, because we just better know what the law is and we get a better knowledge of law, but not in this directly instrumental way.
I fully agree with you. Legal doctrine, or as it is called in German, Rechtsdogmatik, which is a quite strange term if you look at it, yeah, because it contains dogma in it. And dogma means something that mustn't be put into question, but it reveals something about it. Traditional legal doctrine takes certain conventions of presenting legal arguments and presenting reasons for the positions that you adopt in a piece of legal expertise. Yeah? It takes these conventions seriously and for granted, and that's it. And all that you are expected to do is to master this in a beautiful way, in a beautifully respectable way. And you do master it if you have acquired a certain routine, published in relevant journals, of course, and are relatively knowledgeable in your field of law. That's very important, I think, for the standing of a legal academic on the European continent, that you can ask these people basically any question and they will have some answer for you. Yeah. Radio journalists, for example, often approach public law scholars, yeah, with this expectation. Well, we have a problem here in Austria. The Minister of Justice didn't behave well in this case. What is your opinion? Did he violate a constitutional obligation of his? Yeah. So, and then legal experts will say something. That's the traditional expectation. In a sense, the legal scholar that works against this conventional background is a little bit like an intellectually slightly more accomplished attorney. That's it. Yeah, they're on the same level. And attorneys will to delegate certain tasks of legal analysis to them and they'll pay them well for it. And this is how they generate additional income, which is always welcomed by the people who are just into that. Yeah. And then, of course, there is a long-standing tradition on the European continent or in the European context of exploring what is called in German terminology the methodology of legal science, juristische Methoden, the methodology of legal science. And this is more ambitious. This is not something that is part of the task of producing legal expertise proper. Many of the people who are successful in producing legal expertise, even in the academic context, don't bother how it has to be cast or presented in terms of a legal methodology, because nobody out there who requests their expertise is interested in this question. It's a question of no practical relevance in a sense. But nevertheless, in good German law schools, there is a long-standing tradition of exploring the methodologies of legal reasoning and of legal interpretation, legal hermeneutics, and so forth. Now, this has become a relatively small and neglected field of inquiry now. Yeah, it's very interesting. If you look back in history, there were these debates ranging at the turn from the 19th to the 20th century over what legal scholarship can really accomplish. Hans Kelsen's pure theory of law actually was an attempt to demonstrate that legal scholarship can accomplish far less than it purports to accomplish. Yeah? So Kelsen's legal theory is a plea for more modesty in legal science, actually. And that's, I think, this was the greatest part of his contribution that he's made to legal scholarship. Yeah, this call for greater modesty. Yeah. But yes, these scholars are there, but they are rare. Yeah. My dear colleague Michael Potach, for example, in the Vienna Law Faculty, he is very much into the traditional project of elaborating the methodologies of law. Yeah. And he does so in a very, very, very beautiful way, in a very successful textbook that he actually publishes. And he generates interest among his students for all of this. Yeah. So there are these well-rounded scholars in European law faculties who do more than just doctrine, but also reflect on the foundations of what it means to produce doctrine. Yeah.
Now, that also relates to your travels across the Atlantic, because I will be also speaking possibly from my own experience. But once you leave your own home, let's say, and your intellectual home where you grew up and where you educated yourself at first, and then you travel somewhere else. In my case, I also got very much enchanted by the critical scholarship produced on the other side of the Atlantic.
Right.
To the extent that I really liked the way the Americans ridiculed European legal culture. But then at some point of life, you just turn back to your home and you start to see the issues with those enchanting other side of the Atlantic. And yeah. I myself feel that I remain somewhere in the middle, the continental Europe, but also the United States. So do you have some sort of similar experience?
I have the same experience, because I'm also caught in the middle. And being caught in the middle means practically that you belong nowhere. Yeah, you do not belong to either of the two sides, but you're caught right in the middle. And this is exactly what has happened to me in my work. And there's an additional difficulty that I will return to a little bit later. But what has happened to me in my work is that I have a very strong admiration for the legal scholarship that was produced in the 19th century, both in philosophy departments. So I'm very fond of the legal philosophy of German idealists, for example, Hegel, Fichte, so forth. I find this absolutely brilliant. There's nothing like it that has come afterwards. Yeah. On the one hand, nobody, this is, of course, completely neglected in the Anglo-American world, yeah, today. I also find the historical school of jurisprudence actually very, very interesting. And what I try to do in my work is to combine the basic approach followed by the historical school that had a strong emphasis on the three sources of law that they found relevant: custom, legislation or decisions, and then legal scholarship. They looked at legal scholarship as something that is or potentially is a source of law. Yeah, there's something productive going on in legal scholarship. And this is something that I always try to reconstruct in my work. However, combining it with the insights of American legal realism and critical legal studies and so forth. And the result is something that doesn't fit into either legal tradition. This difficulty or predicament that I'm in is compounded by the fact that most of my legal theory work is published in German and not in English. So if you were to ask me, are you a legal philosopher or a EU law scholar, I would have to reply, well, it depends on the language that you read, because in the German speaking world, I count as a legal philosopher, whereas in the English speaking world, I may still pass as a EU law scholar, even though with a certain theoretical perspective. It really depends on where you publish your work and in which language you publish your work. And this is an experience that I've only also made. The folks in Austria don't read any of my English publications. They don't read, they ignore it, yeah, because it's not the language that they work in. Yeah, I don't know what it's like in the Czech Republic, but there's one thing that I find a little bit depressing about the demise of globalization. Yeah, globalization is something that is in recess, in a sense. Legal scholarship is less international today than it used to be 30 years ago, I think. 30 years ago, everyone wanted to go international. Now, no. We stick to our national traditions. So, yes, I'm caught in the middle. I'm intellectually caught in the middle. When I was in the United States, I was still far too Germanic, in a sense. in particular, given that I have this interest, strong interest in German philosophy of the 18th and 19th century. Yeah. So it was too Germanic to fit fully into the American context. And I'm definitely far too American to fit into my Austrian context. Yeah. So I'm right in between, caught in the middle. Yeah.
And do you think that European law can be this last refuge for the rootless people like us? That in fact, because it's not grounded in any of the national cultures, that it allows us to speak about the law without its attachment to a particular legal system. And I must say, I experience this very often when I talk to people who have got their PhDs from the European University Institute, about which we also talked at the workshop, that it is there where people are being educated in that way, that they are encouraged to either take a comparative perspective or European law perspective, even if they do not do specifically European law, but they also inquire into more theoretical or philosophical questions.
That's right. So the European University Institute is a good place for this, and European Union law is a good place. Now, forgive me, I digress a little bit. Legal theory, understood as the exercise to elaborate the significance of certain legal concepts from the internal perspective, and also to take from time to time the external perspective. So if you look at it from this perspective, legal theory is something that travels historically from one field to another. In the 19th century, I think it was based in private law, or maybe in criminal law. Yeah. Then it migrated into public law, and then subsequently into international law, and in particular into European Union law. And there's a reason for this. Sometimes fields of law produce new challenges for legal thinking, simply because of the developments that you encounter there. And in order to cope with these developments, you have to develop this theoretical perspective. And European Union law has, for a long period now, been a good home for those who are interested in theoretical questions. Yes, that's a good home for it. But this aside, let me say something else. This is, let me speak about my utopia. My utopia of legal education is something that is perhaps partly realized at the Central European University. Over many, many decades of traveling between different legal orders. As an Austrian, I went to the United States, taught comparative law, and my basic reference of comparison was always European Union law and German constitutional law. So what I did throughout my life, I was teaching fields that I was never trained in. But I always thought it's interesting to study German constitutional law because it teaches you or makes you familiar with a certain way of reasoning about constitutional questions that is quite innovative and new, and that has produced followership on a global level, that law is not an object to be a mass of norms to be studied out there. No, law is always a way of thinking, a way of reasoning. And what's interesting about the law school experience that you find your way into different ways of reasoning about law, and therefore, here's my utopia. The ideal law school would be completely dissociated from a particular national jurisdiction and should study, for example, French administrative law. It's just one random example. Perhaps German civil law, American constitutional law. And I don't know, we could take something that is excellent in Czech law and add it. With the languages, it becomes difficult. Some things would have to be studied in translation. But I think studying law as a legal academic who is interested always in these moments of self-reflection, you can dissociate the study of law in the long term, I think, from any particular jurisdiction. You can actually use jurisdiction as examples where certain ways of thinking have materialized and left an impact. So it becomes automatically comparative the way you study law. And it becomes comparative because you're interested in these different ways of thinking. Bill Ewald at UPenn has this wonderful expression for this. He calls it comparative jurisprudence. And I think all study of law at the end of the day should be something like comparative jurisprudence.
Which I must say is quite utopian these days, I'm afraid.
Absolutely utopian, I know.
So my question, and that doesn't mean that I wouldn't like this sort of utopia, but in my still relatively short experience as a legal professor, what I observe or have been observing recently is that students are more and more focused on leaving the school and being employable at the moment they leave the school. So they are very much focused on getting practical skills instead of getting this overarching perspective on law, which is universal and which they can bring from one legal system to another. Is it something you have been also observing in last 5 to 10 years, or maybe even longer? But that's the time horizon which I have in my experience.
I've made the same experience here, of course. Yeah, actually, it's very interesting. If I look at the group of young people that I work with together in my department, they look at the legal skills that they received in their training here as something that is a mere instrument for their future job performance, and they do not at all relate it to the philosophical interests that they pursue in my department. Yeah? So I have a wonderful assistant who's just completed a doctoral degree. She's a Marxist and interested in Marxist legal theory. Philosophy is one thing for her. Legal scholarship, or the type of intellectual legal skills that she was trained into, to put it more precisely, is a completely different matter. And if she cannot pursue a career in philosophy, she will use her practical skills to do something else. But they no longer, and this is something that I find quite puzzling, combine their interests. The people of my generation, and we are now the older generation, it's already on their way out, but in the 1980s, 90s, people of my generation, we were interested in making legal scholarship more philosophical, more theoretical, and to add other disciplines. What I find troubling about the generation that is now working for me, yeah, they are all very talented, but what I find troubling is they no longer see any hope that the legal skills that they receive here is something that is worth any intellectual reflection, because it's inert, it is something that is in place, it is something that you have to use to earn a living, and that's it. They look at it as a social fact, not as something that is an intellectual challenge to them. It's a social fact. Quite disturbing. Yeah, thinking becomes a social fact.
So that relates to one of the issues you also raised in the paper in the workshop about the commodification. And that's also something we have already mentioned in the beginning, that part of the people who are employed at universities look at how their expertise can be sold, and the price they get on the market would then determine also their price for the university. But there is another issue which I see, which you didn't mention in the workshop, and that's this issue of increasing pressure on academics to have social impact and to get public engagement, and the rise of the importance of the social media. I should mention that I do not have Facebook. I almost do not read Twitter, and I'm quite old-fashioned, and I have one or three blogs, legal blogs, I mean, which I follow. But I see increasingly, especially among the younger people, there is this tendency to think that the more they are on Twitter, the better for their future employment and their visibility and all that. So how do you think about these things?
Yeah, this I don't have too many encounters with the new world of social media, even though our institute has a Facebook page and we publicize our events on Facebook. Yeah, this is something that we do. It actually changes the overall intellectual orientation. I've just prepared, I told you before we started the interview, I just prepared my student outline again. Yeah, and reading my student outline presupposes that students are capable of reading a text with full concentration of the argument, and to follow the arguments over several pages. It's not just bits and pieces of information that I give them. It's a longer argument. And apparently, in the age where social media give you quick access to information, yeah, where a quick buzz comes out and everyone is reading it, no longer trains people in immersing themselves into more complex texts over a longer period of time. This is something that changes. Yeah, social engagement is also something that has altered the shape of scholarship profoundly. We are moving in this respect a little bit into the American direction. On the one hand, there are those who cater to the interests of those with money and power. So they do economic law and so forth. And then there are those others who are in fields like gender studies, for example, yeah, migration, yeah, human rights. They are into legal academia in order to change the world. Now, good moral intentions do not in and of themselves translate into sound legal scholarship. That's the problem that I perceive here. And the outcome of this scholarship is of mixed merit. Some of it is good, some of it is not so good. And the place for those who are seriously interested into those foundational questions that I was talking about becomes narrower. It is true. It is true. In particular, when you look at funding opportunities, yeah? Those who have funds available, public institutions or the European community, they want scholarship that promises to alter the world, or at least to come up with one or the other proposal that bureaucrats will find helpful for their own projects. Yeah, if you're not into this, well, then it's a little bit more difficult to continue. Yeah, so that's the only answer that I have for you, not more.
And related to this is also the question of the assessment of academic production, if I use these managerial terms, but that increasingly it's again in terms of the number of outputs and other indicators like downloads on the social science research network or the number of citations, that yeah. It seems to me that it's increasingly more difficult to say, this is a really good stuff because I have read it and I really think it's good. Without a follow-up question, why do you think so? And you would just say, because I'm in the field, I've been reading this stuff for 10, 15 years, and I simply recognize that this is a book worth publishing, even if it doesn't have these other objective indicators.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Austria is small. Yeah. If you look at Austria as a country, it's very small. And the Austrian legal scholarship is not really connected to any other country. This is why this large-scale indicators that are used on an international level don't matter so much. But of course, once you go international, you want to publish in the best journals. And my experience has been with the good journals over a long period of time that they always publish the same thing, yeah, because it's always so similar. Yeah, it's always the similar, it's a similar type of scholarship that is reproduced. Yeah, it also serves a certain style. It comes from a certain intellectual milieu that is dominated by the big schools. Yeah, so the authors that work there are cited. Yeah, it becomes relatively redundant is not the right word, repetitive. Yeah, it becomes repetitive in a sense. And I see the same difficulty that you perceive, namely that interesting scholarship that is published outside of these prestigious journals is simply ignored. It runs the risk of falling by the wayside, yeah, as a result of these.
And I must contribute with my own anecdote when I first encountered your work.
I know,
and that
yeah.
is a long time ago. When a colleague of mine was recommending your commentary on the Kepler judgment, which was published somewhere, I don't remember the name of the law review. And I replied, oh, I don't know his author. He's, you know, a European based in America writing for a US law review. Do I really need to read it?
Yeah, right.
And then I made the effort. I read it and you became one of the authors I always follow.
We all use these indicators and clues. Yeah. If I look for literature, there's always too much out there. You select by looking at the more prestigious journals first. Yeah. This is how you do it. Yeah. Otherwise, you're overwhelmed by the wealth of information and literature that is out there. Yeah.
And on that line, I would like to just ask perhaps more mundane, but no less interesting questions to me. And that is essentially your working habits, if I may ask such questions, since, and that's not to say that you are writing too much, but I really admire that I find, you know, first working papers, 3-4 of them, all of them original, insightful, and then 1 year or 2 years later, there is a book published on that topic. So how do you find topics? And also, how much do you write?
Yeah, I tend to write about things that affect me personally. Do you remember my first book on European Union law, Individualism?
Yeah, of course.
I wrote Individualism because I was then a smoker confronted with the requirement to quit in the United States. And it was at that time that the tobacco advertisement directives were out in the European Union and hotly debated and were a constitutional issue before the European Court of Justice and also in Germany. Yeah. And I thought, well, that's an interesting topic. Smoking is an interesting topic. And why a liberal society has so much negative moral energy to spend on this topic? Why is there so much disdain of people who smoke, and why is it permissible to express this disdain in regulations? Yeah, so this is something that puzzled me because it affected me. Then I wrote a book about employment discrimination, or not only the employment discrimination law, anti-discrimination law in general, And it was, again, from my own perspective, that it was inconsistent with everything that I believed in as a social democrat, because I think it fell short of the full-blown social democratic project. It transformed it into something neoliberal. This was my concern, yeah? Now I've written something about, in German, yeah, about the moral beliefs of the contemporary left, in particular the politically correct left. And it begins with a long article on something that is only, I think, prevalent in Germany, the use of certain symbols to use gender-inclusive language. So instead of using the female and the male form, Germans now use the female form and put an asterisk into it in order to include all conceivable genders, yeah, so that you don't exclude anyone. It was for the reason that my university adopted a directive that recommended that all members of the universities now use this asterisk in their writing that I decided, no, this is going too far. I have to write something against it. And this grew into a whole book that goes far beyond this topic now. So often my work is occasioned by this. It's not always the case. Sometimes I'm now working on a completely different project that actually has to do with reasonableness and so forth. Sometimes it is deep philosophical questions that have concerned me or had been on my mind for a long period of time that I finally explore. So this is something that I do. But I often respond to impulses from the environment, and I only write about the things that I find personally important, not because they affect me personally, because I always think, well, if it affects me, it affects other people as well.
Possibly more, let's say, really mundane question, but to me, really interesting. And that's, your writing habits. So do you try to write rather often, every day and little, or do you have like days where you concentratedly write and then you take breaks from writing? So what is your method of writing?
It's a little bit, the development is right now a little bit disconcerting. I'm beginning to write obsessively, which means that if I try to take a day off and to read, I simply cannot complete the day without writing a paragraph, yeah, because I want to be productive and I enjoy it so much. Mm-hmm. I really enjoy writing, and writing is for me the outlet, the escape that I have from everything that surrounds me here in Vienna that is not so pleasant, yeah. The university, the faculty, my department, yeah. I can escape from all these unpleasant things as soon as I'm in front of my computer and trying to write a sentence or two, because this is something that I really enjoy. I think it's fun. It's a fun thing to do. Uh-huh. And I hope it's sometimes shown in my work.
When you explained legal irony in your book on the legal relation, and then you have ironic footnotes. So it really makes a fun experience also to read stuff in legal theory.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So that's it. Yeah. Yeah.
It's visible that it's enjoyable to you to just, write all this stuff.
Yeah.
And then do you take notes handwritten, or do you take notes into the computer, or do you scribble a lot?
This is something that has changed now over the years, as I'm growing older. In the beginning of my career, I always found making footnotes and including literature very cumbersome, always the most cumbersome part of writing. So what I did in the beginning is I made excerpts on index cards for every book and article that I read, and put these index cards together in order to facilitate the writing process, because writing becomes automatically once you arrange these index cards in the right sequence. So my first book was published in German is actually the result of putting index cards together, and all the long footnotes that you have reflect what I had on my index cards. This made writing easier. But of course, it's very time consuming. If you excerpt an article I used up to 20 index cards per article, yeah? Small index cards, yeah? So this is far too cumbersome. What I now do is I look at the important writings that I find really important and still make very detailed excerpts. And I think making the detailed, very detailed excerpts is something that helps me to think about the matters. It's actually an intellectual exercise to do this. And again, I do it in order to make the footnoting a little bit easier later, because there's nothing that I find more cumbersome than having to look something up in a book or in an article, yeah? By going back to the pages. I find this terribly cumbersome because it disturbs the flow of writing completely if you have to do it. So I still do excerpts, but to be honest, what I write now over the last few years, I put everything aside, write it down, and make my footnotes afterwards. This is how I'm working now. And I think it's a question of the age that you have attained. Yeah? Your brain works differently. And I'm losing the patience, actually, to read too many things. Yeah? I still buy a lot, but I'm reading less.
Yeah, there is also this reference, I think, in one of your books that you would love to read more than 50, but you do not have time for it. But you replace this by buying books.
Yes, I can give you a photograph of all the books that I have on Fichte in my library that I haven't read. Yeah, right. But it's really, you will see, you will notice this yourself when you go on over the years, your style of writing, the way you work is something that changes profoundly. Yeah. And it changes for the better, I think. I mean, at least I want to believe it that it has changed for the better.
It's fascinating when you mentioned the index cards. That's exactly what Niklas Luhmann has been doing. And there are articles written.
I actually took the idea from him.
Right.
He didn't accept as much on the index cards as I did. And he was using the same set of index cards, the Zettelkasten, throughout his life. I haven't. I've thrown all my old index cards away by now. It's no longer useful. But yes, I took the idea from him. Yeah, it's not that he gave me that. I took the idea from him. Yeah, and for beginners, I think it's great. Yeah, it's a wonderful way of working. Yeah, a very methodological, controlled way of writing the text.
So I think on that note, we can end by now. I hope that there might be other occasions to discuss these things. I still remember, for me, one of the most enjoyable encounters with legal academics in general was when after a conference in Bergen, I think it was, we sat in a bar, you and Matthias Kuhn, and you discussed patiently Jack Belkin and...
Once
you get to this stage when, you know, after a conference late in the night, I'm sitting in a bar and not discussing anything else than legal theory, and I feel really passionate about it. And that, I think, really describes... passion for legal
Matthias is a wonderful sparring partner, of course. Yeah, this is great. Yeah, I remember this too. Yeah, it was a great conversation that we had.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm sorry that my answers were long, but you know, I'm a professor. Yeah, you turn me on and then I speak.
Music composed by Mikkel Haask-Madsen and performed by Mikkel Haask-Madsen and Jakob Vester.